This is the fifth tape in a series by Thomas V. Taylor, Associate Professor of Church History and Old Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
One summer when I was at Penn, I had a course in history with a fairly ferocious professor who was the wife of the provost. I don't know whether they're living or dead today, because it's 20, 25 years ago, I suppose. She was the wife of the provost. She had enough degrees to paper your living room with. He had quite a few, too. She was a learned woman and a really good teacher, but, boy, she just didn't think a thing about looking at you. When class was over at 10, she could look you right in the eye, and she'd say, "By tomorrow, I will have expected you to read," and then she'd give you a book of 500 or 600 pages. She did not think one thing about it. If anybody said, "I can't get that done, Dr. Nichols," she could just look them right in the eye, and she could say, "You undoubtedly are not the sort of material we want in our programs if you can't get the work done." She could just wither you to the ground. I kind of enjoyed her, maybe because people of that nature have always kind of fascinated me. And she was a good teacher, too. Boy, she could really lay it on. So one day, I sat next to a fellow one day. I sat next to him every day. You know how you just sit in the same chair. He was a novitiate out at St. Joseph's University, and he was hoping to become a teacher in one of the growing up seminaries in Africa. But he was working on a doctorate at Penn in the early stages of it while doing the novitiate work at St. Joseph. So one day, Dr. Nichols called on him to give a recitation. She didn't ask you for one word. She called on you for big stuff. And she called on him, and poor fellow, he said he was sorry he wasn't prepared that day. And he said, "I'm awfully sorry." And he was usually prepared. She looked at him and said, "Well, what was it? Was he not well?" And he said, "I'm awfully tired." And then he explained the details of the life at the monastery, where he'd been on duty in special services and whatnot the last couple of days, and he really had run out of study time, and he was just fatigued. And Dr. Nichols said to him sweetly, she said, "Well, that's all right," she said. "We'll let Mr. Taylor answer the question." And she said, "I understand." That wasn't that, so I answered and went on. The next day, I got to class a few minutes early, and Joseph was sitting there. His eyes were red like somebody had beaten him. His eyes were red. And I said, "Are you all right?" He said, "You won't believe what Dr. Nichols did yesterday." He said, "You won't believe it." And I said, "What did she do?" He said, "After class," he said, "she went and called my superior and told them that if they were not going to give me enough time to study for my courses, that there was no point in them maintaining me at the university. Would they please decide whether they wanted me to study or work in the monastery? Would they please decide?" He said, "Do you know what I've been doing since 1 o'clock in the morning?" I said, "No." He said, "I was sitting at a desk studying this history," he said, "while two monks sat there and chanted to make sure I stayed awake." I'll tell you, for the next 2 weeks, he looked shot every morning. They did let him sleep some, but he was mighty well prepared. Well, if we did that with our students, 80% of them would walk out and never come back. So the Jesuit order was a hard order. Today, softness has hit the Roman church like it's hit the Protestant church, but it still is one of the most resolved of the orders. But in the history of the church, it was a tough order. Loyola put them through a set of spiritual exercises that would drive a weak man crazy. And when they came out with the concept of an iron discipline, absolute obedience to the church, and with no thought of promotion within the church itself. Within their order, they might rise, but none of them become pope, none of them become archbishops. They exist and work within their order. So the Society of Jesus started about 1530, was recognized by the Vatican in 1540 with some reluctance. Now, they tried to work in Jerusalem and win Muslims, but didn't have great success in that. And so after 1540, they gave themselves very much to working against Protestant influences in different parts of the country. The effective principles of the Jesuits were built around a concept. I'm looking at figure C. The effective principles of them were built around a concept that everything, whatever is for the greater glory of God, is good. They were very fond of the expression, "all for the greater glory of God." And if that included torturing you to confess, that was good. Because, you know, God would be glorified when you confessed. And some of them, you know, there are all kinds of different people. But some of them could compromise everything they thought was right to get somebody to make a nominal confession of Christianity because it was all for the greater glory of God. That's not true of everybody. It's unfair to generalize all the time. But the concept of all for the greater glory of God led them to some questionable but very effective principles. Casuistry is the concept that the end justifies the means. You can do anything you want if the means are right. Anything you want if the means are right. You can use any method that's necessary. Catherine de' Medici thought nothing at all of using all sorts of vice type of practices to compromise those whom she wanted to get out of public influence. She did it under Jesuit inspiration, if not guidance, in France. And then there was this matter of mental reservation. Mental reservation meant that you didn't really have to tell your mind. If in your mind, you know, if somebody looked at you and said, "What day is it?" and you really thought it'd be better for them not to know, you could tell them a big lie. You know, you could say, "Well, it's not Sunday, it's Monday." You had to have some reason for doing that, but the reason was known only to you, mental reservation. So there was no compulsion to tell the truth. It's hard to work with people like that. My son has been on a submarine off and on for a long time. He's now teaching in San Diego, so he's not out at sea. But when he was out on his last cruise a couple of years ago, where they go and hide for 3 or 4 months in the ocean, he said to me, he said the good thing about it, many good things he liked about it, he kind of likes that. But he said, as soon as you go under the water, he said, you forget what day it is. He said, nobody cares. He said, you work 6 hours and you're off 12 hours. He said, the only thing you know is, am I on or off? He said, after a while, nobody knows what day it is. He said, nobody knows what month it is. He said, nobody knows what time it is. He said, you know by the ship's bell what hour it is on the ship. And he said, you know whether you're on or off. He said, that's really wonderful. Now, he said, let me tell you about the guys on the ship when it comes to Sunday. He could see that I was, he said, the spiritual fellows, he said, about every third shift they say is Sunday. He said, then there's some other guys that never admit that there's a single Sunday in 4 months. He says, I'm kind of in between them. He said, I like the Bible study, but he said, it's like about once every 7 days, not every three shifts. Interesting how those things kind of go. So here you're on the submarine, you come up to a fellow and say, what day is it? He knows perfectly well he's been down 3 days, and he says, oh, it's just a couple of hours. Can just lie the teeth right out of you, see, under mental reservation. It was very helpful in looking at somebody and promising that if they confessed their sins, you wouldn't burn them. But as soon as they confessed their sins, your eyes popped open and you said, for wicked sins like that, you have to be burned. It's used again and again and again in the annals of church history. And of course, in so doing, you compromise a lot of things. Some people have great confidence in other persons giving their word. So mental reservation. And then there was the concept of probability, the idea being that if any accepted party in the church had ever taught a particular doctrine and not been condemned for it, that it might be right. So you could maybe use it too to get your own ends. You know, if there was one father who had not been condemned for it, but had taught one particular doctrine in the church, you might be able to use him and use his teaching to gain your ends because there was the slight probability that maybe he would be right. If he'd been condemned, that was a different story. Now, that was chiefly used in debate. You could take any position in debate and hold it defensively because there's hardly anything that some father at some time hasn't thought that was right. But with a dedicated core of persons who would work night and day and who would not flinch at accomplishing things, whether they had to lie, cheat, steal, preach, pray, or beg, they were an enormously effective movement, the Jesuit order. How many of you know the name Pascal? Anybody know that name? You know, he's the mathematician and physicist, Pascal. Well, that's really what he was, a mathematician and physicist, but he was also a Christian, and seemingly a Christian who had a real grip of redemptive truth, and a Roman Catholic scholar in a monastery in France, near Port Royal in France. But that was a kind of an hombre-type monastery. And Pascal is famous for Pascal's law and Pascal's theorem and Pascal's wager and a bunch of other stuff like that that Christians like to dabble with. But Pascal, he wrote a meditation book called Thoughts, Pensées, Thoughts, and it's really very nice to read. It's quite edifying. But he wrote a series of letters called the Provincial Papers. He was very anti-Jesuit because he saw these principles as being ruinous to true morality. And he argued that the heart of the church was not its organic structure, but its true morality. So he wrote a series of papers called the Provincial Papers. He just tears the poor Jesuits to pieces in that, with quotes and papers and what this fellow taught and that fellow taught and somebody else taught. When I first read the Provincial Papers, I thought that Pascal must have made it up. I couldn't believe those things. I wasn't able to verify every one of them, but I was able to research back and find a lot of the guys and find what their influence was. And a lot of their writings I couldn't read. They're in very complicated Latin, but the men were there at least, and their influence was there, and their thrust was there. So the order moved very quickly through Central Europe. It did not get very far in Germany. The Lutherans had become very intolerant of Romanists in general. Now, the Jesuits would have a big impact in the next century in the 30 Years' War, but the Germans could kind of smell a Catholic missionary two or three blocks away. But in Sweden, where they were more naive, and in Poland, where they were very naive, and in France, where they were semi-pro-Catholic, and in Spain, where they were quite Catholic, the Jesuits had an enormous influence in ferreting out Protestantism. They were at their best in getting the government, you know, they'd work on it 10 years to get the government to pass a law to outlaw any worship other than at the cathedral. The Jesuits always said, you know, there might have been some one Jesuit who didn't, but they always said, we have all the time God will give us. So if it took them 10, 20, or 30 years, they would work that long to accomplish their ends. And they might pass a particular job, like overturning the Edict of Nantes in France. They might pass it from one generation to the next, the dying generation saying to the coming generation, remember, guys, we've got to get rid of this. We've made this much progress. They were like a bulldog with a bone. The Jesuit order was kind of like that. They grabbed and hung on. And if it took them 50 years to get a law passed, they would work to do it. They could be defeated 50 times, and they would work to do it. And consequently, they were very instrumental in recovering Poland completely for the Roman side. And they were also instrumental in handicapping the Reformation in France and even England. They felt nothing of disguise. They very often worked for years without wearing the clerical uniform. I don't like the clerical uniform, see, but in this day and age, all priests kind of did it. But they would dress as common people. They would work in disguise. They were famous for taking positions as university professors and as people in the court, doing almost anything in the court to be near the chief polyfrog. And some of them were, you know, some of them were fine people and some of them were just slouches. But one thing that could be said of all of them was they were absolutely dedicated to their cause. They had an iron and rigid discipline. And until the last 50 years, it never showed many cracks in them. There would come a time when the King of France would bar them from coming in France. And from several years, they wouldn't be allowed in there at all. He couldn't trust them any more than that. And there'd be a time when the Pope would condemn the whole order. And the order would be disbanded everywhere but in Prussia. I think Prussia, because Prussia was a Protestant state, and they said they were not under any authority up there. There would be a time when they would go through all sorts of things. They have been one of the outstanding missionary orders in the Roman Church and one of the big educational orders. And some of the very finest of the Catholic schools have Jesuit backgrounds. In this country, they worked with the Indians. Father jokes up in New York State. It's easy to be critical of everybody, you know, but Father James Joke up in New York State was determined to convert the Iroquois to Catholic principles. He never really succeeded. But the Iroquois caught him and tortured him and abused him and beat him again and again and again and did all sorts of unbelievable things. They sent him back to France, a ruined man, having cut off this and that and tortured him in unbelievable ways, and went back to France, and the bishops in France simply said that he could, you know, could have a monastery, but he only went back to preach a few sermons, then came back. Eventually the Iroquois killed him, but his whole life was spent, see, in an unbelievable display of attempting to convert the Iroquois to Catholicism. Well, for the courage like that, that's what made the order successful. The order did not have a bunch of weaklings who sat in the background hoping their wives would go out and do the work the next day. They had a bunch of strong-minded persons who would stoop to anything or rise to anything to achieve their particular ends. So they were the first major move in the Counter-Reformation. The second major thrust is the Council of Trent. The Council of Trent. The Council of Trent is not one council, really, but three councils. It met in three separate sessions. I don't think the exact years bother you too much or necessarily bother you too much, but the first session was in 1545. 1545. The second session came to pass in 1551, and the third session in about 1562. The sessions didn't last a few weeks, they lasted months. And actually, they were not in Trent most of the time, but they were there a good bit, the Council of Trent. Trent is a city in northern and western Italy. Not eastern, sorry. I always have to stop and look at the rising sun. northern and eastern Italy in Trent. If the Council of Trent had been called in 1517, as I said before, they'd have probably arrested Luther, condemned him, burned him at the stake, and we would have had a totally different story of the Reformation. But by the time it was called in 1545, Protestantism was set, not only in Germany, but in many of the Norwegian countries, Scandinavia, not all the Scandinavian countries, but in Germany, and I guess you'd have to say in Denmark, and very much in England and Switzerland, and had a large following in France. So by the time they got around to meeting the Council of Trent, there was some attempt to get Protestants to come, and a few Protestants did come, but not very many. And they quickly saw that they were not going to be able to achieve very much at it. An interesting thing happened to Trent. When the council had met at Constance in 1416, the voting on issues had all been done by nations, which meant that every nation had a vote. But at Trent, the voting was done by clergy, which meant that, you know, instead of having 50 nations voting, you now had 3,000 clergymen voting. And since Trent was a part of Italy, it was not hard for the Pope, not hard for Pope Paul, to guarantee that he had a couple thousand of the clergymen there before anybody else got there. So the Council of Trent was very heavily controlled by the Italian clergy. And what his determination to do was to restore the supposed solidarity of Rome and to offset the Protestant movements. I can't mention all the things they did, but at the first session, they took up these three things that I mentioned. I took up a lot of things, but I mentioned three things under figure D on page 12, 2D. They proclaimed that anyone who taught justification by faith alone was a heretic, and that that was a wicked doctrine. That has been reaffirmed by the Roman Church several times. But I tell you, meeting this young woman in one of my classes at one time, she told me with a smile on her face that she was taking instruction lessons to join the Roman Church. I'm not a big critic of where everybody goes, but I, you know, you talk to people. She had a background in an evangelical church, and I asked her why. Well, she liked the ceremonies, and she was marrying a Catholic fellow. That always kind of works together. And I said to her, I said, there are some complications. Well, she said, not as many as there used to be. She was anticipating me, you see. And she said, for example, she said, did you realize, she said, that they've completely changed their position on justification by faith and now teach that you can be saved by faith alone without the church or anything else? No, I said, I didn't realize that. And she said, I'll bring you the paper that I'm studying from that shows it. So this is, again, 20 years ago. So she brought me the paper. The paper had been prepared in St. Charles Parish in western Philadelphia. And among many things it said, beliefs, here down the middle of the page, it cited that justification by faith alone, et cetera, et cetera. It said it very nicely. And everything was in quotes. Everything was taken from statements of popes to show how good a thing the church was. So it said it by justification by faith alone, and it gave a reference to Pope Leo the 13th, I believe, and gave reference to the document which he promulgated it. I had never seen it before. There's lots I don't know, but I was really kind of interested in it. And I said to her, I said, I never saw that before. Well, she said, that's the problem. She says, you've got to keep up with these things, see? So it was time for her to work on me for a minute. But I just took mentally the reference where it was in Leo's encyclical. Went down to the library in Philadelphia that day and dug out his encyclical and discovered that it was article such and such in the encyclicals of Leo entitled The Syllabus of Errors. And this was a sentence taken right out of the middle of the paragraph in which he said it is a damnable heresy for anyone to teach that justification is by faith alone, that men can be, etc. They had just dropped off the front and dropped off the back and just lifted it out to fool naive persons. I mean, everybody does things like that. It's not just, you know, I mean, you don't do things like that, but all sorts of movements do things like that. So the next day I took a photocopy of the syllabus to her and I laid it before and showed it to her and she said, oh, well, that's just one thing. And that's the way it goes. When you're in love, brother, a lot of things don't make much difference. Never forgotten the duplicity of that particular type of thing. Protestants do things like that too. It just goes that way. But the synod that the Council of Trent pronounced justification by faith alone as a heresy and condemned any who taught it. and also announced that the Bible was not the final authority, that the Bible and tradition of the church together were the authorities in which we were built, that the Bible should not be translated into the vernacular, into the common language of any people, since only the priests could really understand it. It removed the Bible from the common people. It pronounced the Latin Vulgate, the official Bible, and in effect forbade the study of anything else. It also announced that the books known as the Apocrypha were to be guarded as sacred scripture. Before the Council of Trent, some Catholics thought they were, some Catholics thought they weren't. But it announced that the books known as the Apocrypha were to be regarded as sacred scripture. So between establishing the Latin text of the Vulgate and establishing the Apocrypha and making the Bible not the final authority, they really effectively removed it from the place of foundational truth it should have had. And then by saying that the lay person could not understand it, and by not putting into the language of the laity, they effectively removed it from the study of anybody but a few monastics. Now, I better tell you that there was one wrinkle in that ointment. A group of Catholics who were driven out of England in the days of Queen Elizabeth, went over to a place in France called Douai. And over in Douai, they just kind of forgot all about the enactments of Trent and the edicts of the Pope and translated the Bible into English, because they said since the English already had an English Bible, they now needed one that would show them the true things. And the Douai version was the only, for many, many years, was the only non-Latin, quote, approved Catholic Bible, end quote, in the world, the Douai version. And the Roman Church accepted it with some chagrin. It's really not a bad translation. In fact, in many ways, it's quite good. But they accepted it with some chagrin. But the English clergy over in Douai in France said that as long as the English already had a perverted translation, it was better that they should make them one that they could pick up the truth. The Douai version is really quite good. If you ignore some of the notes in it, some of them are not that bad, but it's really, in its day, quite a good translation. And the third thing they mentioned was authority. They made the Pope not the absolute authority. That will not come until about 1870. But they made the Pope and the offices of the church the authority. And their understanding of Scripture, their traditional understanding of Scripture, was the authority on which people would have to live and be bound to it. Trent did lots of other things, tons of things at the three sessions. It's not really fair to pick out one aspect. But I mentioned these three. The church became a necessary means in your salvation. Because at Trent, they taught that in Adam, the image of God was lost. That's not as hard to argue over, I think. But that it could be restored in you through the good offices of the church. And part of that restoration could be accomplished after you were dead. They could pray for you. They could ask God for you. And in time, you could be restored wholly. In fact, nobody was fully restored until after he was dead. They had the means whereby you could be reconstituted in the image of God. It could never be accomplished in this life. It had to wait till after death, because after death you went to purgatory, where the sins that the church could not remove in this life were removed under the punishment of God. So it's not uncommon to pray that somebody would hurry up and get through there in a hurry. Well, there are all kinds of people. I have many Catholic friends. I've always been concerned not to unnecessarily insult or injure anybody. I think you have to be careful. I think you have to be honest. But the system of the church does not make salvation plain, period. It's a works kind of thing, and the church can reconstitute that image in you. Now, in the Roman church, I'm convinced, just like in some Protestant bodies I could mention, you'll find people that really know the Lord in spite of the teachings of the organization. I'm sure you'll find some. But I don't think it's the way to evangelize. Make it as tough as you can. And I'll just tell you, see, that between people who are lost, there are lots of Protestants lost. It's not the church people go to that saves them, be it Protestant or Catholic or Orthodox. It's that personal faith in Jesus that makes a difference. Now, there are just plenty of our churches that are Protestant around about here that have less to offer than some of the Roman churches do. So we always say that it isn't where you go to church, it's what you believe in the Lord that makes the difference in God's viewpoint. Hopefully then you won't go to some, you won't go to the first bongo church. But that's the difference. I note on this page the Inquisition. I don't have to say much about it. It was dying in some ways. If you got a chance to see the Bob Jones film entitled The Spanish Brothers, you ought to see it sometime. If you like to see violent things, Dr. Bob Jones plays the wicked inquisitor in it. He really does a great job. We must practice that role a lot. He really does a great job, and he's a super actor. But the Inquisition was effective largely in Spain and countries where the church was on top of everything and ferreting out Protestants. And the fourth major move was the Index, that list of books you could read or couldn't read. The idea in the Index was that if you didn't let your people read these Protestant books, they wouldn't get the Protestant ideas. And you're all familiar with in the Catholic books the imprimatur of the person, the sign of the bishop which says, this book may be printed, imprimatur. And the nihil obstat, there's nothing standing against this book in the judgments of the church. The Index in our day and age is pretty well dead. It still exists, but it doesn't have much force, and today it's kind of bound with the League of Decency on the censorship of films and whatnot. And here I'll tell you, it's an ironic thing. If you really get indignant about some of these gross and morose films that are put out today, and you really say something about them, it's very likely that the fellow sitting next to you will be the archbishop of some place saying something about them too. Because to a large extent, the Roman Church has publicly stood against that type of immorality and debauchery. And if you join in anything like that, you're very likely to. I'm involved not in a lot of things, but a few things. I think we have to make your testimony known against some of these wicked things today. And so if you really go out on the bandwagon against pornography and television and all that sort of thing, you're very likely to have a company of bishops and maybe a couple of Christians. It's hard to tell who will show up, but we always say that when you're fighting in a war, you don't ask if the man with you is tall or short or if he drinks his coffee with his right hand or your left hand. You ask if you have a common enemy and if he's one of them or not. That's what you want to know. That's what you want to know. So the Index attempted to keep people from reading books. They put everything on the Index originally, tons of scientific stuff. But you know, the Index served an interesting function among learned Catholics. Against persons in the villages, it served its place as well. But among learned Catholics, the Index kind of gave them an idea of what they would like to read, what would be nice to read. Oh, it's been banned by the Pope, has it? Well, let's find out what it is. And oftentimes the Index worked against them at scholarly levels and academic levels. So the Roman Catholic scholars in the last 50 years have been more liberal than Protestant scholars again and again and again. The Counter-Reformation was not mounted as a single thrust, but as a varied machine. And consequently, it's hard to assess its work totally. But it certainly helped stem the growth of Protestantism. And in the next century, after the Reformation, in the next century, it will be largely responsible for the famous 30 Years' War. A great war fought between Protestants and Catholics for supremacy, with neither side really winning. But millions and millions of people die. But having talked about the Society of Jesus, I was saying a few words about the Council of Trent when our last class came to its end, whatever that end happens to be. I had discussed earlier with you the problems in Counter-Reformation, the difficulty they had getting off the ground. Then I had talked about the Council of Trent. I had mentioned its meetings, the three phased meetings of the Council of Trent. I had mentioned how there was a correction in voting procedure. And that correction was very important from the point of view of the papacy because it now allowed the Italian section to control the whole meeting of the council. Now, the Trent councils always met near Italy than they did Spain or France, and consequently the Italian clergy were able to control them on a simple vote basis bit by bit. I'd mentioned also that the intentions of the Pope were not to let the council govern him, and then I had mentioned just a few of the outcoming points that had been particularly irritating as far as the work was concerned. I didn't want to stress these totally or altogether, but I did emphasize and told you a story about the rejection of justification by faith. And I mentioned also the concept that the Bible was not to be translated into vernacular, although the English church got around that through a device, and that the authority was returned to the Roman system. The end result of the Council of Trent, when all said and done,
was that it made a much tighter structured church. The final council, the final sessions were in 1562, 1563. The emperor was Ferdinand, and Pius IV, the Roman archbishop of that time, the Roman bishop of that time, I don't think you need to pick up all the names. He was a new pope and fairly diplomatic in what he wanted to do. Consequently, the church after the Council of Trent was much more molded in a general pattern. Now, many of the things that we know in the Roman church were unpopular then, and I'm sorry, many of the things which we did not like in the Roman church were certified then. But from a practical point of view, the Council of Trent was the making of the modern Roman church up until Vatican II. There has been a substantial change in the Roman institution since Vatican II. It hasn't been, in my judgment, as I've told you several times, very much for the better, but it has been there just the same, and we really can't deny that. I guess don't really want to deny it. It's been there, and we've kind of lived with it. But the Roman church of my boyhood days, and college days, and seminary days, and some of you your boyhood and girlhood days too, that Roman church was pretty much framed at the Council of Trent. The Apocrypha had to be received as scripture after that. Justification by faith was emphatically denied. The authority of the church to control the rite of salvation was reaffirmed again, and any sort of dissent was set aside in the favor of the authority of the fathers of the church who had gone before it. Then I also had mentioned the Inquisition, but only briefly. The Inquisition had really been begun many years before, back in the 13th century, and was largely a means of attempting to remove from the church the group known as the Albigensians, or the Cathari, or the We Are Holier Than You Rascals group that existed in France and Spain at that particular time. The Inquisition had long been under the direction of the Dominican Order, and the pictures of the Dominicans in their inquisitorial role was a very striking one. I mentioned to you the Spanish Brothers film by Bob Jones, how Dr. Bob Jones Jr. did so well at dramatizing the villains. But the use of the Inquisition in the Reformation period was probably somewhat less than you might otherwise have expected it to be. And the reason for that was fairly simple. Much of the countries in which the greatest Reformation influence was felt had never really been exposed heavily to the Inquisition. I'm not saying it wasn't there. But it thrived in Spain and in southern France. The Germanic territories in Austria saw far less influence of it. So it was not a well-known tool there, in addition to which the Protestant princes in those countries were sufficiently strong to control themselves and not to be swayed by it or to allow it to operate in their territories. What the Inquisition did do was effectively provide a check against Protestantism in Spain and in France and in other such places. It did that, and did that rather well. But in that particular connection, we can only say that the inquisitorial forces effectively held down Protestantism, but they were not much of a force in uprooting it or preventing its growth in Central Europe. I mentioned also the Index. The Index was the concept of a list of books that you could read and you could not read. I mentioned the difficulty of implementing those, and to a lot of people, when the whole thing is over, the Index merely tells you where the really good stuff is. It's like giving your young people a list of places not to eat pizza. It's a good way to tell them, you know, where you can follow it from there, I think. So I'd offer to a brief assessment of the work of the Counter-Reformation. The long-range work that was most effective was that which was done to the Jesuit order. I mentioned earlier that they were responsible for turning back the Reformation very much in Poland, and they had a very handicapping effect on it in France also. So the Jesuit order was enormously effective in holding back the work of the Reformation. But it was about the only part of the Counter-Reformation it really was. It will become increasingly effective in the century after the Reformation with the 30 Years' War and the attempt that the Roman princes made to overthrow the Protestant princes militarily and vice versa. The Counter-Reformation tended to galvanize the Roman Church into a system. It tended to make it harder for there to be any dissent within it. It tended to make its machinery authoritarian. And in that sense, it served to cut a clear distinction between it and the Protestant bodies building around it. But otherwise, it did not affect the total picture very much. It did not win many people back to Rome, except where it could get a military majority, and they could either go back or be shot. It gained some in situations like that, but really did not gain very many. However, it was a necessary move in the force of things, because without it, the Roman Church was simply limp before the criticism of the Protestant princes. And that criticism, of course, would be devastating in time without any corrective device. Now we'll go to page 13. Page 13, and talk with you a little bit about Roman numeral 9, theological progress in the Reformation. Now remember the chart by which we worked this out. We began by talking about the backgrounds, and we talked about the Reformation in Germany, Reformation in Switzerland, we talked a little bit about the Anabaptists, talked about the Reformation of Calvin, talked about the Reformation in England, in the various other countries of Europe, and then the Counter-Reformation. And now we pick up some notes on the theological progress in the Reformation. Capital A, the theology of Rome at the onset of the Reformation. The theology of Rome at the onset of the Reformation. Now I mentioned seven steps here, and I probably will take more time with them than I should, but I want you to understand how they go. By onset we mean, just say 1500 AD. We can only see the theological progress of the Reformation as we see what it had to work against and what the forces were that worked against it. So here at the theological progress in the Reformation is the theology of Rome, say 1500 AD. The authority was set not in the scriptures, but in the papal offices of the church and in the general councils of the church. In the papal offices and in the general councils. Authority was also set in the fathers and back in the traditional doctors of the church. Although it was not yet as emphatic as it would be in a few years after the Council of Trent. So if you went back to 1500 and said to any man in the street, what is the authority upon which we were guided? He would say, it's the church. The church dispensed salvation. The church could also send you to hell. But the church's authority was built in the papal offices and the administrative persons, and the scripture was only secondary or tertiary, second or third, behind that particular source of authority. So as far as men's souls were concerned, the church itself constituted the great authority over men. God was kind of second to it, and God's scripture kind of third. The church structure was built largely around the authority of the Roman bishop and the bishops whom he would appoint. However, there was still a lot of argument over that. Lots of kings liked to appoint bishops. When a king would appoint a bishop, that would be called a lay appointment. The technical term in church history is lay investiture. A layman would reach out his hands and put it on somebody and put him in office, and the church officials in Rome would scream whatever church officials scream. Murder, maybe, or blasphemy, or any number of other things, but they would cry out and lament over it, because they would see that as a layman put an ecclesiastical person into office. They could not tolerate that. However, they constantly feuded over it until the time of the Reformation. It won't be until after the Reformation, until the work of Trent is over, that the church will have a final and complete grip on that particular thing. But the church structure is much looser than it will be later. Many of the monastic orders thought of themselves as being independent and self-sufficient in themselves. But the authority generally, as I mentioned before, was the church and the papal office within it, and the structure of the church was loosely built around that papal office. Every group wanted the recognition of the papal authorities, although some of them, as I said a moment ago, thought of themselves as being quite independent. The Franciscans are a good example of that. They were certainly loyal to the church, but they thought of themselves as being independent and not really being tied to it tightly or in a forceful sort of way. So the third item is salvation. How did the church view salvation? Essentially, the key word is this, S-Y-N. I'll write it on the blackboard, S-Y-N. E-R-G-I-S-M, synergism. The church regarded man as having to work together with it in order to obtain salvation. Now, God gave it, but God gave it through the church. Therefore, the idea that you could get it without the offices of the church being employed was an idea that very few people countenanced or tolerated at all at this particular time. Consequently, it was promoted that you could not be saved without the services and the work of the church. So the salvation was dispensed by the church. You obtained it through the sacraments, which I will mention in a few moments, but you obtained it, and in connection with that, you could not be saved without the church's consent and without the church working for you. A man could never really be sure of his salvation. The concept was that the image of God had been destroyed in man, and that the church, by its good offices, would try to rebuild that image and try to bring man back to the point where he could know and could be like God again. The various things that the church did to help that included pilgrimages. Pilgrimages, sacred celebrations, special blessings, special masses or communion services. All of those things were used by the church to help a man, quote, get saved, end quote. Now, certainly there were some people in the framework of Christianity who knew the joy of the Lord. The Lord always has a group that are his. We can't name a lot of them. We do see a few, like Thomas a Kempis and men like that, who seem to have a real rich grip and appreciation for the free, saving work of Christ. But we do not see many like that. Those whom we do see are almost like shadow figures on the stage of time. Sounds pretty poetic, don't you think? They kind of pass by and are gone before our vision. And there probably were many, many others. Simple people who had heard and believed the gospel. But I'm talking about the formal outreach teaching of the church. Men could hardly know they were saved at all under any circumstance. The best they could hope for would be a quick trip through purgatory. Salvation was based on the breakdown of the sin problem. Sins were broken down into venial sins, little sins, carnal sins and venial sins. Sins which could hurt you slightly and sins which could hurt you eternally. Carnal sins, you could be forgiven rather easily. Venial sins, you might suffer with a long time. But there was no sin so great that it could not be burned away in purgatory if you had enough relatives and they had enough money. Consequently, salvation was taken completely out of the vocabulary of the average man. And you know, sometimes today we think of the millions of people who haven't heard and our hearts ache for them. But my heart has always ached for those people in the Middle Ages, many of whom could not read or write, who had to depend on others for what they heard, and consequently never really heard a saving message that was not cluttered up with tons of sacerdotal things by the church. The word sacerdotal means doing things to save yourself, or doing things to receive grace would be a better translation. So there were lots of things you could do to be saved, but you could never really know it. You could never really feel assured of it. You could never sit down at night and say, if I died tonight, I'd be with Jesus. The best you could do was hope that the church by its offices would help you to slip through as quickly as possible. The sacraments. The sacraments were those institutional acts supposedly given by Christ to the church to help it appreciate his work and to enable its people to enter more freely into its grace. Hope you're not trying to copy me word for word. The sacraments were those institutional works given by Christ to the church, ... to help the people more fully enter into his grace. In Baptist bodies, they like to call them ordinances because they like to get away from the word sacra or sacred. Sacred enactments. But whether you are successful in getting away from the word sacred or enactments or not, that I don't know. But that's what the sacraments are. The sacraments are new works. I'm sorry. The sacraments are sacred works. The Roman Church had seven of them, and these seven were drawn largely out of its traditional history of the last 500 years. Among those seven, we find the sacraments of baptism and communion. They were at the very start of things, and along with them, the sacrament of confirmation. When you get beyond confirmation, past the concept of communion and baptism and confirmation, then you run into things like holy orders, the arrangement of your life to be lived for the church and before the concept of God. You eventually will run into final unction, the concept of being forgiven your sins at the very end of all things, the sacrament of penance, doing things to make up for the sins that you've now done, and the seventh of those sacraments, the wedding sacrament, marriage being an act of receiving grace. All of those things were tightly tied up. Penance, of course, is immediately connected with confession. All of those things were tightly tied up with the superstitious structure of the church as a body that had the power to bring these acts to bear on you. Consequently, they were all under the direction of the church. If you wanted to be married, you were married by the church because marriage was a sacred act in which grace was conferred to you. If the emperor married you, what could you get out of it? It's amazing how much in some parts of the world those things have tangled things. I'm really not a world traveler, but I remember when my in-laws first went to work in Brazil, the difficulty they had in working with those people who had been married by the state and the church didn't recognize their wedding, and those people who had been married only in the church and the state didn't recognize their wedding. It was possible to have a wedding certificate and be married 20 years but not have it recognized if it came out of the wrong issuing authorities along those lines. But the church was anxious to guard itself in the control over every man's life. So when you were born, you were baptized. The church pronounced an initial grace on you, which supposedly washed away the state of sin in which you were found at birth. When you were died, they poured a few drops of wine and a crumb into your lips in order that you might receive final unction, that you might receive a final forgiveness just before you left, that at least would make purgatory easier for you. I hate to sound so negative about those things. If I sounded as negative as I felt, you wouldn't be able to take it. But I'm always struck by the way that the upper echelons of an ecclesiastical society attempt to find ways to keep the lower echelons dependent on them. It's not so bad in Protestantism, but it does occur in Protestantism more than once. I don't dare give you any illustrations of it now, lest we get carried away completely, but it does occur. So the Roman Church was built with a concept of authority in the papal office, a structure that was rather loose, but built around the environs of Rome, a saving concept that was largely synergistic, in which a man could hardly know where he was, and the sacraments, which were institutions supposedly given through the office of Christ, that would enable you to know grace and to know something of God's saving love. The fifth aspect in theology was this matter of calling, tied closely to the sacrament of holy orders. The idea was that some men were given to a holy calling. And by that I mean a life to serve God. Now, we're not going to argue with that. We're not going to say that serving God is not holy. But the idea was that they, per se, by what they were holier than anybody else. And consequently, they could often take the freedom that came with that and turn it into a very ridiculous degree of license. So here the poor people didn't eat fish on Friday. That was true until Vatican II, incidentally, for many, many years. They didn't eat fish on Friday. But at the monastery, they might very well, they did eat fish on Friday. At the monastery, they might very well serve beef on Friday if they felt like it, because they were holier than the common person. Now, that would not have been true in a godly monastery. In a godly monastery, they would have gone by the rules of the church, just as they expected others to go by them too. But many of the monasteries were not godly at all. And because the people who were called there were of a holier level, they could freely break the laws of the church, because when you're that good, who can say anything against you? The popes had long declared that they were not responsible to any king or government, but responsible immediately to God alone. And then they had said that all the bishops were only responsible to them. So that if a bishop committed a crime, you could hardly arrest him for it. Although in England, they arrested them and executed them sometimes. In other places, the bishops had a tough time too. But that was the idea. The nature of the holy calling divided society into a bunch of those who were somehow specially God and uniquely endowed, and the rest of us. So if you were a physician, that was good. You could make money, but your calling was not honorable before God, not holy before God. And holy orders, along with calling, tended to divide the society very heavily into strong segments. And then in the theological progress, there was the matter of scholasticism. There was a great attempt within the Roman society to Christianize the philosophies of Aristotle and Plato. Aristotle in particular, he's the great thinker. If you can comprehend Aristotle quickly and easily, then you probably ought to be teaching these classes and not just taking them. And maybe by now, you actually feel that you are. Who knows for sure? But the attempt to Christianize the philosophy of Aristotle and to indicate that he really understood the basis of life and to bring his ideas into an interpretive frame of reference as far as the church was concerned was a big thing. In scholastic efforts, the church had made itself a worshiper of the great thinkers, particularly Aristotle and Plato. A number of other classical thinkers too. Now, I am not hostile to those men. They certainly were bright boys. I've enjoyed reading Plato's dialogues, and I haven't really understood a lot of Aristotle, but I kind of enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed looking at his triangle of being and becoming and non-being and all sorts of other stuff like that there. Talk about these great men with that bad grammar, that ought to do it pretty well for one day. But the church tended to pedestalize them, tended to make statues of them, and allowed them with their unsaved thinking to become the men who devised the standards of theology and morality and practice. Now, the big champion of that was Thomas Aquinas. There are some good things to be said for Thomas, too. But he was a big champion of that. He thought that men who had the thought capacities of Plato and Aristotle could not be bad men. They were pre-church, paganized type of persons. Consequently, he Christianized their ideas and brought their philosophies in to rule the thinking of the church. The Scholastics worked with this problem of what reality is. And in trying to determine what reality is, they tended to make the populace to whom they ministered victims of an educational device. That doesn't tell you much, does it? But victims of an educational understanding, so that men of little skill or little ability had little hope of knowing anything or attaining to anything. Education was almost raised. Education was almost raised to worshipful heights under the Scholastics. And then there's the comment on humanism and scholarly advance. Item 7, the theology of Rome. Humanism in the Middle Ages. It seems to me I've said this before in this class. And you know, I get these three or four classes all covering the same ground, and I make all kinds of blunders. But you'll remember there are basically three kinds of humanism. There's classical humanism in Greek and Rome, where they flex the muscles and build bodies for themselves. There's the secular humanism of today, in which we try to outrule God completely. And then there was the Renaissance, or the medieval humanism, in which man was seen as a creature of God who ought to get better treatment than the governments of the world had been giving him at that time. A Reformation humanism. Now, that Reformation humanism is pretty interesting. It develops pretty much in the 15th century. You'll find men like Lefebvre, L'Fevre, Lefebvre. You'll find men like Savonarola, S-A-V-A-N-A-R-O-L-A, Savonarola. And, of course, the famous humanist Erasmus, E-R-A-S-M-U-S, Erasmus. These persons looked at man with sympathy and challenged the church to treat man like a creation of God and not like a beast. Consequently, the Reformation humanism is really centered around God's creation of man. And many of the Reformed leaders in the great history texts are called humanists because of their concern with the improvement of man's law. Think of Calvin in Geneva making laws for how the saloon should be run and making sure that there was no gambling to steal your money. And while Luther was not as tight as Calvin, think of Luther arguing for the freedom that men ought to have from the tyranny of the church and tyrannical systems. Think of Menno Simons. There are hardly any of the reformers that are not thought of as humanists by historians in our day and age, because as humanists, they can be understood for their interest in man. We who are Bible believers ought to have a better interest than we do, and by God's grace ought to work to seek to try and cultivate it and develop it. The Roman Church, the Roman system, understood humanism at the start and tolerated it. But as that humanism challenged the church for the control of men's souls and lives, the church became less tolerant of it and less tolerant of it, and eventually would not accept it at all. Of course, you can't just take something like humanism and just chuck it all out. It's there and you can't get rid of it that easily. But to a large extent, the church would not tolerate it at all. Now I come to capital B. Those are 7 points in the theology of Rome at the onset of the Reformation. Capital B, the human lot and prospects in the 16th century, 1500 onward. Ecclesiastical. Little truth was really witnessed in the church. And mankind could at most hope, you know, that your son could become a priest or a cleric. Then there'd be some chance of him being saved and praying for you. But to look to the church for leadership in the 16th century was like in the Old Testament when the prophet describes leaning on Egypt as a man who leans on a rod that's pointed and it runs through his hand. There was no solid ecclesiastical leadership apart from those things that the Reformation produced and brought to light in due time. The social lot of man found society pretty much freed from the feudalism. Feudalism is pretty much over. But society is still rather developed into two camps, the haves and the have-nots. And there are a lot more have-nots than there are haves. That was the big cause behind the Peasants' War during the Reformation period in Germany. Millions of peasants with nothing found it easier to revolt and try to get something than to continue to live under the direction of kings and nobles who seemed not to care for them. There was, of course, always the possibility that if you were skilled enough and improved enough, you could improve yourself and develop your lot. Someone like Luther's father, Calvin's father, they were men who did such things. But there was not great possibility for that happening. The great likelihood was that if you didn't have much, you would stay that way. And the eternal prospects were purgatory and hell, apart from those people who knew the real truth, which I've said before, the Lord always has some of them about. But apart from them, the real prospects were purgatory and hell. Neither one is very much fun to look forward to. So if you hear some sudden noise on this tape, besides the wiggling and jiggling, it'll be that the basketball players have hit the gym below us and they're practicing out. The Lansdale Christian School people come here and practice basketball in our gym. It may explain why they lose most of their contests. If you hear a big noise or a bump or a thump or a whoop or a yell, it will come from them, not from somebody cheering this lecture or booing this poor professor.
This series is concluded on the next cassette. Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or more information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.